just be fearless, right? The client may say no. The prospect may not buy our service, but like, tell them what you actually think. You know, we actually build a lot more trust when we meet with a prospect and tell them all the things that are wrong with their business, right? And all the things that we can then help them fix. So just be fearless and go for it. I think it helps starting companies. I think it helps in the sales cycle.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I am the CEO, co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got the Chief Strategy Officer of Graphet Finance with me, Chris Mosa. So Chris is not only the finance manager, but he's a master of financial storytelling, if you look him up on LinkedIn. Chris, thanks very much for coming onto the show. Whereabouts in the world are you today?
Hey, James, good to be with you. I'm in North New Jersey, so about 30 minutes west of Manhattan.
Fantastic. So I think what listeners are going to get out of this is many, many people have started a fractional CFO business. In theory, all you need to do is change your LinkedIn description and bang, you're maybe a fractional CFO. What happens after that, though, very few people manage to actually build a business that is worth selling and can be sold as a fractional firm. So we're going to talk a little bit inside baseball today about how Graphite has managed to do that and how they have managed to build not only, you know, revenue and profits, but enterprise value as well. But before we get to that, maybe you could just give us a bit of your own background and how you came to Graphite and the founding story, if you like, of the firm.
Yeah, so I'll start with my founding story, which is because I came to Graphite not as a founder, but as a, you know, I'll explain how I joined the leadership team. But I was in professional services for about 15 years, doing a whole bunch of different things. I started in the Big Four, went to work for a handful of other companies. I ended up taking a CFO job with a Series A fintech SaaS company in New York City, a company called Advisor. And I got brought in, I was kind of fractional to them before the Series A, and then they brought me in full time post Series A. And I spent a couple years there, and it was a phenomenal experience, really, of having gone from client service to on the ground operations. I ran fundraising for them. I was a key part of the management team. We made a bunch of strategic decisions. I ran customer success for a little while, marketing for like all the things you do in a startup, in the startup world to kind of keep the company going. And so I had that experience. We ended up exiting that business. We sold that business a couple years after I was there. And I was the only finance person on the team. And so I had this weird experience of working with our investors from 11 to 12 o'clock one day, and then arguing with ADP about a payroll issue, like from 12 to 1, and then paying bills, but then it being a strategic partner to the management team and providing pricing guidance. So there was this real dissonance around all the different functions of a traditional finance department and having to flex across all of them and be competent and capable in all of them. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel, as we exited the business and I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, it didn't feel like something that was sustainable or the best model. And so I started thinking about this concept of, you know, how do you scale a finance department with the right people and all the right swim lanes for venture-backed, early-stage venture-backed companies, right? How do you do that and do it at scale and be able to build a service model that expands and contracts based on where the customer is? And so I started doing that. It kind of was just me, one part-time person to get started. I think we did it in a way that was different. We were optimized for the customer versus what we needed. So what does that mean? Customers in that space want predictability around fees. Everybody's gotten a legal bill or an accounting bill with a bunch more hours on it than they expected. We built a recurring revenue model, which was a real difference maker for us. So we would spend the time up front, really, you know, dial in what it would cost us to do a thing, to the thing that they wanted us to do, and then give them a fixed price through the contract term, and really did that for a number of years, and kept reinvesting that back into the company. Right. So classic, you know, kind of founder story. Year one, I took no compensation, right? Every month I'd go to our savings account. My wife would say, how many more months are we going to do this? Keep doing this until we turn that corner. And so every dollar that we made, we put back into the engine, because in our business, smart people are everything. the people are, what you're selling, what's in their heads, their ability to deliver value every day. And so we did that. We built that up. And ultimately, we were approached by a larger company in the space, Graphite Financial, for a potential acquisition. We worked that process. I got to know the CEO here, who's a phenomenal guy. He's the founder of Graphite. We had a lot of alignment on values, on our approach to client service, more importantly, our approach to our people and our teams. And so we put that deal together, which was not really my intention when I kind of set out to do that, to stand up that firm. And we put that deal together about 18 months ago, and I joined the leadership team here in a strategic role, and have really been here growing and building with the Graphite team ever since. And so that's kind of my origin story, from client service to internal to entrepreneur, I guess, to, you know, having an exit. And then Graphite's story is, Graphite was actually started within a venture capital fund. So as a service to their portfolio companies, the investors, the analysts were getting a lot of junk data from their portfolio companies. They said, we can help them with this. They started doing that. They started doing it for companies outside of the VC fund. They ultimately spun Graphite out as a separate company. And Graphite's been an independent, you know, kind of service provider, I would say, for the last 9 years or so, and really built a presence in this space. So when we brought the firms together, there was a real kind of meeting of the minds on how we could build a big platform together.
Okay, well, let's just set the scene here about what traditionally, when, you know, a CFO comes together, is building a practice as opposed to just a lone practitioner. In my mind, you know, you've got highly skilled people. So like when you hire a CFO in, you need CFO number 2, 3, 4, 5, 10. You know, if they can, they are highly skilled, they're obviously very smart, but they understand the value they're delivering, and they can very easily walk out the door. And I guess this is the same challenge that, like, for example, law firms have dealt with for hundreds of years, or even doctors' practices, I guess, where you end up with these structures where there's, you know, a billing amount, an hourly rate, you know, a third is for the practitioner, a third is for the practice, and a third is, you know, for overheads, or, and that would be a traditional way to do it. And it's very attractive because you can get straight away. It's very easy to onboard people. It aligns, you know, for the most part, aligns people in the right way. But you took a harder path, but on the flip side, those businesses almost never get bought because you're only just buying the expertise, if that expertise can walk out the door anytime it wants. So was that a conscious decision to buy some, to build something that could scale and could be acquired? And I guess it was a much harder way to do that in the first 18 months that you alluded to than just billing hours and everyone understood what the value of an hour was, et cetera.
In some cases, it was actually easier once we got started, because after we signed up, you know, a new client, you know what I never had to do? I never had to explain the bill to them. Right. So you ask attorneys and accountants and people that bill by the hour, a big part of what they do in client service is explaining why they spend so much time doing a thing. We never had to do that. Okay. So in that sense, it made our relationship with the client completely about the service quality and the thing that we could do for them as practitioners and professionals in the space. I would push back on you on one thing. You said it, the incentive structure in that traditional model seems to be right. I think it's right for the practice. I think it's wrong for the company, and it's wrong for the client. When people are incentivized to either get paid more, or clients are going to get charged more the more time someone spends, there's very little incentive to be efficient. There's very little incentive to do something in a way that drives the same value, you know, over less time. I mean, metering people's time is such an archaic way to, as a statement of value. Right. I mean, that's what you're trying to demonstrate to your client. The fee should be aligned with the value. And if the value has something to do with how much time I spent doing something, then the more time I spend on it, the more value theoretically I created. I just don't believe that model works. I think it's upside down. And I think you can demonstrate value in a lot of other ways. It doesn't mean that there aren't challenges in the way that we do it. We've got to get pricing right. We don't get as many bites at the apple, right? If we miss on that scoping or on that proposal pricing, we have to live with that through that. We might have to live with margins that aren't where we want. But overall, when you build a portfolio approach, you have some of those that you didn't get right, but you've got a lot that you did get right, and you got a lot that you did better than what you thought. And, you know, that portfolio model has worked for us really well. It worked for me at my firm. It's certainly working for Graphite now. And so, sorry to be a contrarian on that point, but I don't believe the incentive structure in the traditional model is right.
I love that. So let me ask a question then, right? So yeah. how do you manage scope creep? So for hours, yeah. It's very clear. Extra hour, extra, you want me to do that? Yes, sir, no problem. Extra 2 hours, it's all sort of built in. But then yeah. On the other side, if you have a fixed rate or whatever, a scope creep comes in, it's very difficult when you are the person delivering the service to then turn around into sales mode and say, well, actually, you're not on the right tier here. You know, if there's a conflict there, because sometimes it can damage the relationship with the client if you're arguing over scope all the time.
Yeah.
Did you come across that, and how do you manage it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple answers to that. There are a couple ways, I should say, that we do it. So we spend a lot of time in the sales process educating the client, right? So we've got tiers of service. We're very, very clear about what's included in each tier. And those tiers go from operational accounting through traditional accounting, through FP&A, through tax, all the way up to the CFO level. And so we're educating the client. We're spending a lot of time with them before they even sign the contract, because we've had to go through that process to really understand their business really well. We're dialing in and connecting the thing that they want done to the thing at Graphite that accomplishes that. And so I would say that's preventative, right? On the detective side, how do we manage scope creep? We don't ask the client service teams to say no to their clients. We have a dedicated customer success function that has a parallel relationship with the client so that the service delivery teams are not in that position, because we want them only thinking about the service, right? I want our service delivery teams across our verticals only thinking about how do I be the best partner to the client? I don't want them on the business side. It distorts the relationship. So we have a customer success function. Sometimes it might be someone in sales as well who has a relationship from the sales process that will connect in those cases when something has bubbled up that, hey, somebody has consistently asked us to do this thing that is beyond the scope that, you know, that they've hired us for, and we'll attack it that way. And when I say attack it, it's just a conversation with the client. And most of those conversations are not surprises. The client knows that, you know, they're asking us to do a thing, and just getting, you know, recentering on what they bought from us. And then also saying, we can do that thing. It's just, it might be an expansion. It might be, you know, we might just have to put another product or another service on your, you know, on your account. And we're happy to do that for you. We typically won't do that the first time though. So like our model is very much about partnership. So our client service teams will go beyond the scope, the first instance, probably even the second instance, just to be a good partner. If it becomes repetitive, then we sort of, you know, attack it the way I said.
Okay. So in that way, I mean, this is not sounding dissimilar to the way we run our software company. We have some clients who are more demanding, but in aggregate, you know, in aggregate, it kind of evens out. So you sure. Don't need to sweat every service hour. Once you know you have a model, you're looking at the bigger picture and you say, okay, well, we'll just keep going. Have you ever been in a situation where you'd have to offboard a client? Or actually, is this one of these things where you're worried about it, but it's never really a problem, as much a problem as you might think it is in practice?
Well, in our world, because of who we're servicing, right? So 90% of our client base are early stage venture-backed companies. And what that means is they're all in some stage of a fundraising mode. They're all typically burning cash. They're not profitable yet. Some of them are profitable, but a lot of them are burning cash. So where they spend money and how much is a very real concern. So we do have to think about that, right? We do have to understand who our customer is, and we can't, you know, all the time say, hey, I can do everything for you, but it's going to cost something that I know is going to blow up your budget. So it's a conversation, and you know, we're trying to do the right thing for them, but we're also trying to do the right thing for Graphite. It's very rare that we can't find a creative set of economics that gets them the service and that gets and allows us to keep them as a client. That might be we're deferring some payments or we're financing them for them for a couple of months. It might be we pause billing for a month if they've got a fundraising that's about to close. Like we'll work with our clients in a lot of cases, especially if people are working in good faith, The hardest thing is to stop the servers and start it up again. So we try to do everything that we can, even if we have to stop getting paid in the short term, to keep the service going, because the quality diminishes with that start and stop model. So we get creative, but you know, there are cases where like we just can't do something for what somebody wants to pay. And that happens.
So you look at the bigger picture again, in aggregate, it's not going to happen that often.
It's not going to happen that often. And we look to the lifetime of the client. And so we have a really good lifetime value here. Okay. We have a really good time on platform. We're not trying to make the last dollar on every hour that somebody works. So we're expecting to be on, you know, in partnership for a long time.
Okay. So you threw me some red meat there, which I can't avoid going for, yeah, which is businesses burning cash, my lifeblood, you know? So when you have a new client, maybe they have a big round, like, what's your approach to instilling the right approach to burn and spend management within, oftentimes these companies are not even companies yet, right? They're not even stood up. What's your approach to instilling some sort of discipline in the executive and throughout the company when it comes to burning investor cash?
Yeah. So the first thing that we would do is you've got to have really clear line of sight on when your lights out date is, right? If you don't know that date, every founder should know exactly what their lights out date based on the operating model that they're using at that moment in time. Okay. So we help them figure that out if they don't already know. Once we have that figured out, especially in our tier two motion, which is when we have FP&A alongside accounting and we're doing projections with them, we're doing more strategic finance. We're giving them a lot of opportunities to look at different scenarios, right? We want to build them different pathways to say, this is the plan that you're on. This is a base case scenario. Your lights out is 6 months from now. We can make these adjustments to either to spend. We might have a different set of, maybe our revenue projections are off a little bit, but here's another scenario that will get you 9 months. And what 9 months means is you can start fundraising in three, and that still gives you 6 months before your lights out, right? Here's another scenario where things don't go the way we think they're going to go. Here's a downside scenario where you might be out of money in 4 months. That's just as valuable to know as the potential to extend it. And so we're doing a lot of that. We're always running 3 to 5 scenarios for our companies at any point in time. So they know that there are different pathways and then they can plan for that, right? They can start having fundraising conversations or they can make operational tweaks to the model. They can not onboard that enterprise seller next month. They can wait 3 months. They can, you know, not add a new software platform. Maybe they should push that out and keep a manual process for a little bit if it means they can fundraise a month or two later, which gives some breathing space. So having that tool in place to be able to run those scenarios, super key.
So there's a tool. Now, in my business, which is probably not a great example, I was looking at the budget the other day. My partner said, yeah, we're on tab, the first tab. It's like budget Q4 2024. I said, oh, I got it. So no, I meant budget Q4 24 final. Is it that one or is it Q4 final, the last one? You know, like we end up with all these scenarios. So how do you keep all those scenarios communicated and straight with everyone so everyone knows actually which budget we're actually working on today?
James, it sounds like you need our tier two service. Yeah, we should talk about that after the podcast.
It's a gimme. It's a gimme. Yeah, maybe we do.
Yeah. I'll tell you the way that we approach that. So our FP&A service is just that. It's an FP&A always on service. The tools that we use are products, they're outputs. It helps us do our work, dashboards, reports. We've got all kinds of, you know, financial models that we'll build. The always on service means you're getting two people. So anybody that's engaged with us for that is getting a senior finance manager and a financial analyst that works for them. So you're not climbing through the file trying to figure out what version. We're telling you, here's your base case. This is what we're comparing your actual performance every month against. But we've also built these two other edge cases that are really important to understand, right? And we're taking you through that as your financial analyst or as your VP of finance. Our goal is not to build you a model. Our goal is to replicate what it would feel like if these people all worked for you full time and what it would feel like to have an internal finance team. And so I think the way we manage around that is on the service side, not so much on the tool side. I mean, certainly the tools we use are really well laid out and they're clear and, you know, somebody should be able to pick them up, but it's the service wraparound that I think makes the difference.
Very good. So what I heard there was, I mean, it's like someone having someone on your team who owns that basically. So if there's ever a 100%. Query, you go to Chris, he's the guy, he knows exactly what it is, not that spreadsheet from 6 months ago.
Yep.
You're owning that whole thing. And someone who can actually not just give you the raw data, but give you the advice around it and be able to tell you why we changed it and why we're on version 15 and what the strategy behind it is.
100%.
Okay. So I want to ask you a little bit about modeling, because I know modeling is part of your service offering as well. I guess this is for putting business cases together. Fundraising, it's very important to be able to show.
Yeah.
But so what's your approach to modeling? And specifically, you know, anyone can kind of do a cash flow projection and drag everything out to the right. Yeah. But what data sources do you go to put in the assumptions? You know, the assumptions are everything more or less. So how do you build a model that the investors can have confidence in?
Yeah. So it starts with good accounting, first of all. It doesn't start with the model. It doesn't start with the forecast. And so our tier two service, actually, it's our tier one service plus FP&A and financial modeling and things like that. So we presume and we work under the assumption that we own the accounting. So I have confidence in the accounting data and that the jumping off point is solid. The second thing is we spend a lot of time, especially upfront in an engagement, understanding the client's business. So a model doesn't just sort of appear in week two or week three of an engagement. We're in a lot of consultation sessions with them to understand what are the drivers, like what makes your business move forward, move backward, move sideways, like what are all those things? Are you a marketing-led go-to-market function? Are you a sales-led go-to-market function? Who's doing top of funnel? What's your conversion rate? Historically, how much of your sales, you know, account executive quotas have been achieved? What's that achievement rate? How should we think about modeling that? What's your lead cost? Like, we're getting into that. We're using the historical data as one source of truth. We're using management commentary as another source of truth, because maybe things are changing. Maybe you're working with a new agency. Maybe you've just hired two enterprise sellers that weren't in the historical numbers. And so we're gathering all that data. And then we're starting to stand up a very sensitive model that is either typically a top-down or a bottoms-up. And there's reasons to do one or the other of those, but those are kind of the two silos that they fall into. And we're iterating on it over the first couple of weeks. We're showing you, like, here's everything we heard. Here's a base case. Let's start with that. Here's everything we heard. How does this feel in terms of reflecting your business over the next 6 months, 12 months, maybe 24 months, depending on how far we're going out. Maybe it's 5 years if we're building a fundraising plan. That's a 3 to 5 year fundraising plan. And so there's a lot of iteration that goes into that. Once we get that base case locked in, and more granular, by the way, is always better than higher level. So I don't want to see one line item for a number of people, you know, that we're going to add over time. I want to see the people. I want to see who they are, what roles they're in, what the allocation by department is, where that's going to hit my P&L, what the geography looks like, what the fringe, like I want to get real granular. It's always easy to summarize up. It's very hard to sort of unpack if you start too high. And so we build that base case, we get it really well dialed in, and then we say, okay, let's pretend that doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because your sellers only achieve 75% of quota instead of the expected 90%. Let's build that scenario. What's your lights out date? Now let's say your cost of acquisition comes way down. Maybe your marketing motion, your channel strategy is working. You've zeroed in on a channel strategy that's producing 1.5 times as many leads top of funnel. So your sellers are getting just more at bats, right? And they're converting at the same rate. What does that look like on the upside, right? Is there a potential here? Is there an opportunity case? We wouldn't build a business around that, but what would that look like if things sort of broke our way on one or two variables? Let's just see what that looks like. And having those things in parallel and being able to work those cases can only happen because by that point, we know the company really well. We know how they do the thing that they're doing really well because we've spent that time with the team.
I'm laughing because, you know, cost of acquisition coming down is something I've never seen, not ever. I'm glad to hear it's a thing, but not for us ever.
It was an example. I didn't say it happens often. It was an example.
Okay. All right. And then one last question on modeling then. So I had a call with I think it was a PE firm the other day, and they had, it's very clear that they're putting cash in. So they're very focused on the top line. you know, how could you 10x your business, James, you know? And when we're running the business, you can kind of do that as a mental exercise, but you're more or less thinking, well, how can I get that sales guy to close 50% better and build that way? So is it when you're in a funded environment for sort of, you know, growth stage startups, do they come to you saying, listen, I've told the investors we're going to get to 10x, you know, what do we do? Or do they build it the other way around, you know? Or do they just, is there a kind of a, I've sold this thing to the investor, now we need to figure out how to do it. And then you're trying to fill the gaps there or tell them what they would need to do? Or is it sort of based on trends and what's going to happen in the future and what they managed to do?
Yeah, more often the latter. It's very rare that somebody will come and say, I have to grow the business 10x or 5x. And like, let's build that out as a reasonable case. There is an approach there. I wouldn't say it's 10x or 5x, but a top-down model, right? And this is mostly for companies that don't have their selling mechanics really dialed in, maybe earlier stage. Yeah. They don't really know what their true cost of acquisition is. They don't know what the quota attainment is. Maybe they don't even have that history. So it's sort of hard to model all of those different variables in. So sometimes a top-down model is more appropriate. And we say, what do we really kind of feel we need to do as a business? And maybe that's 2x growth next year. Maybe we need to double the business top line next year. And then we'll work backwards and say, okay, in order, based on the things that we do know, in order to go out and get that much revenue, here's where we need to invest, right? And we need to back into, here's how many sellers we need. Here's what our marketing budget needs for the top of funnel spend. You know, that's one approach. I would say a bottoms up approach tends to lead to a better outcome if you've got those metrics, because you know what that data is. And you're saying, here are my inputs. I'm also constrained by the capital that I have. So yeah, I could go hire 15 sellers if I know I have a really good model here for seller quota achievement, right? And they all hit 90%, or most of them hit 90% to 110% every year. Well, great. Let me just go hire 10 more of those and we can 10X our business. Well, but I don't have unlimited capital, right? So, you know, those partners have only put in so much. So unless I'm making money, unless I'm profitable, I've got to manage to my capital constraints how much, even when I have perfect information that if I just push more money here, I can drive a better outcome. And even that's not often so certain. But even in that case, I can't hire 10 sellers. I can only hire 3 sellers. And I can't even hire the third one until 6 months from now, right? And so what's the best that I can do with what I've got? That tends to be where, you know, where our conversations are. It's almost never happens where somebody says, build me a model that shows me 10X growth.
So just to round the conversation out now, we'll fulfill the promise of the podcast, which is, you know, you've managed to sell a fractional CFO business, very unusual thing to do. How was that for you personally, Chris? Was it all rollover, or did you have an opportunity to take some risk off the table? How did it work out?
Yeah, so we're backed by, you know, Graphite and, you know, CPM, which is my company. We're backed by PE sponsors. We've got a great sponsor, a company called Red Iron Group, who's really thoughtful about investments in the space. And so the short answer is it was a mix of those two things. And so it wouldn't have been interesting to me to not stay invested in the company. Like, I'm very much was setting out to build a big fractional finance department as a service company. And I get to do that here now. And so, you know, not being really closely invested in the company would not have been an interesting deal to me. And so that was a mix. I would say, we don't think of ourselves as a fractional CFO service. Fractional CFO is one thing that we do, and it's something that we actually don't even do the most of, right? We're a full finance department. And I think that was a difference. A fractional CFO is very much driven by the specific professionals. I think in our case, we have phenomenal professionals, but it's also driven very much by process and the things that we've done internally to be able to deliver an efficient service and a cost-competitive service to our clients. And then putting really smart people behind that process. And so that is a little bit of a nuance, I think, between sort of a pure fractional CFO practice and us, where you're just, you know, much wider in terms of service delivery.
Well, I can tell by your energy, you've obviously got plenty of juice in the tank for this one. You're still going hard at it. We'll just wrap it up by asking, you know, I have my rinky-dink question here. Who's your business hero if you had to pick one, and why?
Yeah, so I'm going to take an unconventional path here. So this is actually not a business person. I took a path at one point where I thought I was going to be a journalist, and I went back to school to become to journalism school to do business journalism. And I had a wonderful experience. I had a wonderful professor there that in the context of journalism, her guidance to us was two words. It was always be fearless, talk to everybody, talk to, you know, even the most senior person, a politician, somebody that you think that person's never going to talk to me, like just be fearless in the ask. If you have a little bit of trepidation, it's going to be very hard to be successful. And she was talking about journalism, and that be fearless kind of just stuck with me. And so, I mean, it's probably something I say to myself in this context all the time, like just be fearless, right? The client may say no, the prospect may not buy our service, but like, tell them what you actually think. You know, we actually build a lot more trust when we meet with a prospect and tell them all the things that are wrong with their business, right? And all the things that we can then help them fix, right? So that just be fearless and go for it. I think it helps starting companies. I think it helps in the sales cycle. I think it just creates more of a, for me, it's something, a mantra that I just kind of say to myself all the time, even though it's done in a different context. So that's been really, you know, has been really impactful for me.
I love that. Be fearless. Just do the hard thing. Eat the frog. Like do the, face up. That's where the value is, like all the time. Pretty cool. Chris, you've been a great guest. And if you're listening to this still, thank you very much for getting this far into the podcast as your reward for being such a dedicated listener. You're getting something that none of the other people that faded off early are getting. And that's an opportunity to look at a webinar that I created for especially for fractional CFOs. You can get it at procurementexpress.com/partners. And in there, we have a case study of Ben de la Credas. Ben is a fractional CFO based up there in the Massachusetts area. He specializes in working with biotech firms. And Procurement Express is part of the toolkit he brings in when he's working with a new startup specifically there. And he uses that to get his arms around cost control and put a name against every line item in the operational side so that the entire team can be held responsible for the spend that's going on to make sure that the capital is being deployed the way it should be and they can maximize the value out of it. So also in that webinar, I offer my own approach to how I think a fractional CFO or CFO role is probably the most effective hire you can make. It's the most powerful hire and probably most undervalued hire that in many businesses, especially in the growth stage over that sort of, you know, 2 to 10 million range, getting the right fractional CFO can be a superpower. But to be honest, Chris, they're not all as good as you. Not all fractional CFOs are brilliant at explaining that value. So I put in there a 4-part framework. If you are a fractional CFO and you want to capture the maximum value for your clients, explain exactly why it's the best hire they could make. I put that framework in there as well. So go ahead, go to procurementexpress.com/partners, and that's your reward for getting this deep. Chris, I'm all pumped for the rest of the day now. You gave me great energy. I love this talk. This was great. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, James. Thanks for having me. It's great to talk to you.